raised. Each impact was stronger than the last, each one lifting the raft, until on the heaviest collision so far, the raft flipped until it was nearly vertical. Everything slowed down. Talia had her back to the water, her helmet dipping in and out of the flow. With a lurch, she felt the railings buckle and then begin to give way. She sensed herself beginning to slip off the raft, into the sucking water. She unwrapped her elbows and threw herself belly down across the raft, as far and fast as she could, scrambling her heels on the decking to gain some tiny purchase. She let out a groan of desperation, more scream than groan when it burst from her mouth, and then Sparva had her, hooking his free arm around her right elbow, using all his strength to haul her over to his side of the raft. The pod that had struck them had rebounded again, and Sparva's weight was causing the raft to tilt back to the horizontal once more. Talia grabbed a railing and felt her heart hammering in her chest. "Thank you," she said, her voice hoarse. "If you hadn't caught me." They were through the worst of it. They had traversed the lock, and now the flow was calming, the obstacles in the water moving further apart, not closer. It was only then she noticed that Brig had gone. She met Sparva's face, glanced back along the raft's length to the section of railing that had been ripped clean away, and then back to Sparva. He shook his head. "Maybe she'll be all right," she said. "I saw her go," Sparva answered, and his tone told her everything she needed to know. The squad would arrive soon, she knew, and they would do all they could to find Brig. But that process would be strictly one of formality. Talia's mood hardened. It was one thing to be threatened in the course of her investigations, but the death of an innocent civilian put a cold fury right through to her. The water level eased as it redistributed itself between the opened partitions. It continued to shake them back and forth, but each time a little less violently than before, until it was safe for both of them to relax their holds on what remained of the railing. Sparva was the first to stand, his low center of gravity giving him an advantage. He looked out beyond the raft, further into the second partition. Then he touched a hand to Talia's elbow and said, "Look." She looked, staring out across the eddying, debris-filled chaos of the water. It was quite obviously why Sparva had demanded her attention. "The white tree," she said. Sister Catherine had interposed herself on the path, blocking the way. "We didn't invite him," she said. "He just came. He arrived half an hour after you. Said he only wished to speak, to present his opinions, and then he'd be gone. You know we can't, won't, turn anyone away." Dreyfus made to squeeze by. She raised her stick, just enough to remind him of her authority. "Let me see him. You'll make trouble, Tom." There was a steely resolve in her eyes. "We saw what happened a few days ago, when you went to his speech. I didn't think you took much interest in the news." "I don't, but I do take an interest in you. I won't judge you for the past, but we won't have a similar scene happening here." "I'm sorry," he said, pushing past as gently as he could. "Tom!" she called out. Dreyfus twisted around. "He didn't arrive here at the same time as me by chance. It's deliberate provocation." "Then don't rise to it," she said, with a note of dwindling expectation. Dreyfus came into sight of the speaker. Garlin was standing before a small gathering of mendicants and some of their more lucid patients. He had stepped onto a wooden chair, leaning slightly with one hand planted on the chair's back, the other outstretched, smiling as he spoke about the benefits of life beyond the glitter band. Two suited civilians flanked Garlin, standing with their hands behind their backs. Dreyfus recognized the faces from some of the public broadcasts he had studied. They had a hard, single-minded look to them, like former soldiers or mercenaries. "You have their respect, and that's all very well," Garlin was saying. "The citizens of the Glitter Band, if they give you any thought at all, know that you serve a public good. But still you depend on handouts and favours, barely keeping the air inside your world while the rest of the Glitter Band drowns in prosperity. But the breakaway habitats would value your services very highly. A tithe, applied across all the habitats in our new community, would pay for the upkeep of the hospice 100 times over. Garlin trailed off, his smile hardening. I don't believe who it is. I don't either, Dreyfus said, drawing the gazes of the mendicants and most of their patients. Get down from the chair, Garlin. Whatever game you think you're playing, it ends here. Garlin remained on the chair. His two bodyguards straightened up and puffed out their chests. Game, Prefect Dreyfus? Aren't you the one playing a game? Garlin looked out to his audience. Their attention split between the speaker and Dreyfus. I've come here freely, as is my right as a citizen of the Glitterband. The Ice Mendicants very kindly allowed me to speak, on the understanding that I would state my case and then leave. That was my intention. It was all very amicable. I was just coming to my concluding remarks when you stormed into the proceedings. I was already here, as you were already present when you interrupted my talk a few days ago. I didn't interrupt. You picked me out of the crowd. Garlin nodded sagely. At least you were wearing civilian clothing that day. Unlike now, with that uniform and weapon of yours. Well, if the purpose is intimidation, I feel suitably intimidated. He narrowed an eye, squinting at Dreyfus. Are you worried about something, Prefect? You certainly look like a worried man. He straightened up, standing fully erect on the chair. Once more the focus of attention. We've all begun to pick up on the rumours, haven't we? There's something loose, something they can't control. But rather than treat us as adults, men like Dreyfus would rather bask in their secrets. People are dying, I hear. Dreyfus unclipped his whiphound. He held it in his hand, the filament not yet extended. Julius Devon Garlin Voy. I am detaining you under the Articles of Public Order on authority of Panoply. What? Garlin said, throwing his hands wide, looking around with a mask of plausible astonishment. What have I done? You have committed actions detrimental to public order, Dreyfus said. Step off the chair, please. Dismiss your helpers and accompany me to my vehicle. We'll continue this conversation in Panoply. He felt a hand on his wrist. A soft voice.
This is a mistake, Tom. Stop before it's too late.
He tugged his wrist away from Sister Catherine's grasp. I'm sorry, he said. It shouldn't happen like this. But I have my responsibilities. He can spread his lies about the breakaway movement as much as he likes. But when he starts spreading dangerous rumours... Even if they're true, Garlin asked, still on the chair. Is it against public order to state the truth? Dreyfus stepped nearer the speaker. Come with me, Garlin. You wanted a reaction from Panoply? You've got one. You've got witnesses now, Dreyfus. Don't do anything you might regret. Dreyfus touched the control on the whiphound, which deployed the filament. Touching the ground, the filament formed a traction spool and allowed Dreyfus to release his grip on the handle. The whiphound tracked alongside him, waiting for an instruction. The two bodyguards moved in front of the chair, shielding Garlin. Get out of my way, Dreyfus said. They're going nowhere, Garlin said. They know full well that you're exceeding your mandate. Track my gaze, Dreyfus said in a low voice. Mark and acquire 3 subjects. He looked at the two bodyguards in turn, then Garlin, holding his focus for a short but definite interval. Confirm acquisition. The whiphound nodded. Minimum necessary force. Incapacitate subjects 1 and 2. Proceed. The movement was almost too fast to track. The whiphound coiled and uncompressed, throwing itself through the air, flinging out its filament just as it landed within reach of the first bodyguard. In a fluid extension of the same explosive motion, the whiphound wrapped its filament around the lower left leg of the bodyguard, and then yanked it out from beneath the guard, hard and fast enough that the guard gave out a yelp of pain, even as the whiphound was executing a similar operation on the second man. In an eye-blink, both men were on the ground, on their backs, staring out along their legs as if they were surprised to find them still attached. The right-hand bodyguard had caught Garlin off balance as he toppled. Garlin leapt off the chair, just barely catching himself. He wobbled, threw out his arms, started backing away, then turned and broke into a semi-jog, as if he hardly dared run faster than that. "Nothing's broken," Dreyfus said, striding up to the two fallen bodyguards. "That's how it'll be, if you're smart enough to keep out of my way." Then he turned his attention to the fleeing man. "Garlin, you're already marked. Make it easy on yourself." Garlin looked back. The whiphound was swiveling its handle to track him. For a moment, barely gathering his breath, he seemed to find a calmness. "I should thank you," he said. "You've just proved every point I was trying to make."
"I saw him again," Julia said.
"What?"
"Spiderfingers. I saw him on that bed, the way he was before, just lying on his back, dressed in his black clothes, with that bag on the floor, asleep, except he looked half-dead. That hair of his was all lopsided. I think it's a wig."
Caleb looked scornful.
"You were imagining seeing him the first time."
"I wasn't. I told you I'd seen him in that room, and he showed up that day, didn't he? So I wasn't making it up."
"You overheard something is all, or caught a glimpse of him moving around and made up a story about him being asleep,
or got lucky." "He was in the house then. He's in the house now. You'll see. What made you go back to that room in the first place, brother?"
He looked at Caleb, fixing him with a pitying expression.
"You know what? We've both felt it. We've been building up to something for weeks. There was a strange atmosphere about Mother and Father yesterday, and even worse this morning. They're only ever like that when Dr. Stasov's due."
Julius waited for Caleb to deny it, but even his brother would not have been that dishonest. There had been a heavy, apprehensive mood around the shell house in recent weeks, as if the boys were being subjected to some quiet scrutiny, watched and measured in readiness for the next step in their education. Usually these build-ups led to a visit from Dr. Stasov. Julius had a tingle in his belly just thinking about what might be coming. They had been called to one of the main drawing-rooms. Its walls were lavishly plastered and painted in pastel shades. It was full of antique furniture, old glass-domed clocks and writing desks, even a very strange kind of hollow clavier that had solid black and white keys that you had to press down to make a sound. The boys were invited to stand on gold carpeting while Father and Mother delivered a lecture. "It's time for you to learn a little more about the family name you've been blessed with," Father said, puffing himself up with overdone solemnity. "Great things will come your way because of that name. Doors will open and opportunities come your way. You will go through your lives feeling the respect and gratitude of a whole world, and many beyond this one. Your great-grandmother, Sandra Voy, was the architect of our very way of living." He nodded at her portrait, set on one of the walls above an elaborate settee. "She made us who we are, and who we are capable of becoming." Julius and Caleb regarded the portrait. There were similar ones all around the house. A severe old-fashioned woman in severe old-fashioned clothes, standing at a metal-framed window, with one hand on the sill under the window, a book in the other, and the curve of a red planet visible beyond a window. Julius struggled to think of anyone having warm feelings towards the regal-looking woman in the picture, with her unsmiling features, and a peevish, judgmental look to her eyes. "Sandra Voy died too soon," Father was saying, "but not before her great work was set in progress. Under the ice of Europa, she founded the first of the experimental Demarchist communities. There, people explored new modes of participatory democracy, eventually circumventing or dismantling almost all the traditional structures of hierarchy and government. Rule by the people, for the people, with neural implants to facilitate rapid polling and decision-making." The boys took this in with only mild interest. None of it was entirely new to them. They had soaked up enough about Sandra Voy to know her place in history, just as they had more than an inkling of how society worked beyond the environs of the shell house and its dome. Outside were hundreds of millions of people, living on the surface and in orbit, going about their lives, content for the most part, guaranteed a high degree of safety and security. In return, all they had to do was vote. Many times a day, questions would appear in their heads, matters both large and trifling, and the people had only to register their opinion. They did it, whether they were living in the height of luxury or in the self-inflicted hardship of a voluntary tyranny. This was the way human society had worked around Yellowstone for over 150 years. There was no central authority, no government, no ministries, no chambers of power. There were only the citizens, participating in democracy at such a seamless level that it almost became an autonomic process, no longer, except in very rare circumstances, requiring conscious intervention. Such a system had to be watertight, of course. In many ways, the brilliance of Sandra Voy lay not in her advocacy of real-time democracy. It was hardly a new concept, even in the early days of Europa, but in the envisioning of the neural processing architecture that made it both efficient and inviolable. The implants, the abstraction, the polling cores, these were her true and enduring gifts. Mathematically ingenious methods of voter authentication, vote tallying, relentless error correction, and bias elimination. It was as beautiful and intricate as watchwork, and it functioned. Flaws had been discovered over the years, certainly, but they were subtle enough that no real harm had been done before they were plugged. That work continued, for no system as complex as Yellowstone's could ever be said to have reached a state of perfect culmination. What mattered was that Sandra Voy's foundations were still at the heart of the system, for all it had been embroidered and filigreed. In all significant respects, she had achieved her goal. "But no idea," Father said, "can be left to chance, without guardianship and protection. All ideas meet resistance, even those that are demonstrably good and true, and even the strongest ideas need nourishment, cultivation, protection and stewardship in times of crisis, when good men and women may lose confidence in that which has served them so well before. Sandra Voy understood this, and it has been central to the family ever since. Chandler Prentice Voy understood it during the early years of Chasm City. No change was made to the abstraction architecture without Chandler's direct and careful oversight. The changes have been fewer in recent years. The system works so well now that there has been little need for adjustments. But still, we Voys recognize our burden of responsibility. A delicate, fragile thing has been entrusted to us, and we are obliged to pass it forward to the generations to come." The boy's attention was wandering. They knew that being a Voy came with strings, that the price for growing up in a place like the Shell House was that they would have to do their bit when they got older. Neither boy was all that troubled by this coming burden, though. If their parents' leisured lives were any barometer, doing their bit wasn't going to prove particularly onerous. "You are boys now," Father said, "but soon you must become citizens. When you are a few years older, you'll be free to move beyond the Shell House, into Chasm City and the wider world. Your mother and I have done our best to equip you for that transition. You have learned to shape and conjure the immaterial and the material environments, to don plumage and command quick matter. You have learned well, and we are proud of you both. There is more to citizenship, though." Father looked at Mother, waiting for the merest nod of acknowledgement before continuing. She seemed to withhold it at first, before giving in. "Now you must accept the mental architecture which will permit your full participation in Chasm City democracy, opening your minds to the polling cause." The father closed his fist, then opened it again, a grey tetrahedron floating in the cup of his palm. He offered the tetrahedron to Caleb. "You understand a symbolic exchange," Father continued. "This will feel no different, to begin with." "What's going to happen?" Caleb asked, reaching out to accept the tetrahedron, but stilling his hand at the last moment. "It will seem like waking," Father said, "like knowing the world for the first time with clear eyes, like finally being alive." "But it won't be sudden," Mother said.
striking her usual cautious tone. Like everything else, it takes time.
Under her breath, Julius thought she muttered, "Thank goodness." Caleb took the symbol and closed his own small fist around it. The tetrahedron fizzed into nothingness as his fingers punctured its surface. Father closed and reopened his own fist and offered a second tetrahedron to Julius. "Take it, son."
"I like it the way it is now," Julius said,
looking at Caleb for support.
"We're not old enough to vote, so can't we wait until then?"
"Are you frightened?" Father asked sharply.
"No," Julius asserted. "I'm not frightened. The polling system can't hurt us. Millions of people have this, so there can't be anything bad about it. It's just a way of voting."
"Among other things," Mother said.
"The sooner you get used to it, the better," Father said. "Look at Caleb, how ready he is. Why can't you be more like him, Julius, instead of hanging back all the time?"
"Maybe he's happy to be a child,"
Mother put in darkly.
"They went through enough, Marlon. Why can't we have this for a little longer?"
Father controlled it very well, but there was no missing the anger that flashed across his face, or the fact that it was directed squarely at his wife.
"They've had loving childhoods," he said,
speaking the words as if she were the one who needed persuading.
"No two boys have ever been better looked after. No two boys have ever been better equipped to take their places in society. Caleb is willing. Julius must make the same commitment to the life of a boy."
Julius made a lunge for the tetrahedron and squeezed it hard, spiting his father, even as he obeyed him.
"I said it wasn't fear, but I don't understand why there's this stupid rush to make us ready. First the plumage and the quick matter. Now this."
Father stepped back, as if all of a sudden he feared Julius.
"These aren't simple skills."
"People come in from space all the time," Julius said. "On the ships from other systems, ultras and their passengers. Sometimes they haven't got implants at all, and still they adjust and become citizens."
"But they aren't voids," Father countered. "They don't have that name to live up to."
"What if I wanted a different name?"
Julius asked, with a defiance that made him feel a bit giddy.
"What if I wanted to call myself something else? What if I wanted a different life?"
"You don't get to make that choice," his father said.
Later that day, when the boys were in their bedroom, long after they should have been asleep, Caleb said,
"I was right, and you were wrong, Julius. You made it up about Dr. Stasov."
"I didn't,"
Julius said softly. The lights were out and the house still. Their parents slept in the other wing, the one they were rarely allowed to enter. But the boys had learned to keep their voices low anyway. If they spoke too loudly, especially if they argued, Lurcher would hear them and come up the stairs. The robot would never punish them directly, but it would report back to their parents, and there were always consequences.
"If he was here, we'd have seen him, wouldn't we?"
Caleb went on.
"Maybe he was here," Julius said. "Something happened to us today, didn't it? Dr. Stasov's always here when something changes. But he didn't necessarily need to show himself. Not now there's all that stuff in our heads. You know he's got things in that bag that can pick up on what we're doing, even if he's in another room."
"Now you're just making things up,"
Caleb said, turning over in his bed.
"Imagining things that aren't real, like you always do. Do you want Dr. Stasov to come into our room and take us away? Is that it?"
Julius thought of the ghost-faced doctor stealing into their bedroom while they were asleep, that sweep of hair hiding his eyes as he stood in the doorway, a study in monochrome. Then coming to the side of Julius's bed and drawing back the bedclothes with his spidery fingers, each of them too long and thin, brittle as a tree branch. He imagined the doctor taking him out of bed while he was still asleep, and stuffing him into the black bowels of his bag. Julius couldn't be sure a boy would fit into the bag, and he didn't care to put it to the test.
"He'd take you, not me,"
Julius said.
"I bet you'd rather he took you. Then you wouldn't have to face up to those commitments Father was going on about. I could see your face. You looked as if you were about to cry."
"Poor little Julius,"
He made an exaggerated bawling sound.
"Shut up, Caleb."
"Why? Don't you like hearing what you sound like? What if I want a different name? What if I don't want to be a boy? Pity Julius. Boo-hoo-hoo."
"Shut up,"
Julius hissed. Somewhere in the silence of the house a door closed. The boys froze instinctively, straining to hear what came next. It was exactly what they feared, the slow rhythmic plod of Lurcher's footsteps.
"Now you've done it,"
Caleb said, squeezing deeper into his bedclothes. But Julius listened more carefully.
"He's not coming this way,"
he said, once he was certain of his judgment.
"If he was, he'd be on the stairs by now. He's going along the main hall to the entrance."
Julius slipped out of bed. As quietly as he could, he made his way to the bedroom window. Only a year or two earlier, he had needed to stand on a box to look out, but now he could easily manage without it. He eased aside the curtains, peering out through the glass to the nocturnal scene below. At night, the dome's facets turned dark to block out the glow from Chasm City, and the lights, high in the dome's apex, threw down a pale, silvery cast, just enough to define the edges of the terrace and the start of the gardens, with gravel paths radiating away from the shell house, forging into increasingly dense greenery. All was colourless and still.
"What?"
Caleb asked irritably. Julius was about to pull the curtains back together and return to the bed, when a moving shadow came into view. It was travelling away from the house, ticking back and forth like a clock's pendulum. He watched it with an eerie sense of foreboding until the cause of the shadow came into view. A pale gleam of silver showed. It was Lurcher, walking slowly away from the shell house. The robot had gained that nickname because of its slow, top-heavy gait. But there was more to it this time. Lurcher was carrying a dark form, stretched limply across two of its arms. Two legs dangled from one end, a hand, a sleeve, and a silver flash of hair from the other. Lurcher was also carrying a heavy black medical bag. Julius watched the robot recede along one of the paths, soon lost in the darkening gloom of overgrowth. He returned to bed and said nothing to Caleb. Chapter 8. Omonier was in the tactical room, accompanied by a small, weary retinue of prefects and analysts, when a chime diverted her attention from the current topic of death forecasts and response projections. "One civilian casualty," she said, reading aloud from the scrolling transcript. "Bankal and Eng both safe, and assistance should be on site within a few minutes. It seems some safety interlock failed and the entire contents of the reservoir chamber were allowed to spill into the adjoining partition. Enough air and water for the entire wheel. All released in one go." Robert Tang scratched under his eyes. "An accident?"
"Conceivably," Omonier said, without much conviction. "These old habitats tend to be bug-ridden and particularly prone to failures when they're being gutted for reoccupation. But in view of the timing, I'm not minded to view it as anything so innocent."
Mildred Dosso fingered a lock of lank hair.
"Sabotage, then?"
Omonier gazed at her levelly.
"That this event should happen just as two of my operatives are inside the wheel? How else should we consider it, Mildred? Bankal and Eng could very well have died. From what I'm reading, it's a miracle they didn't. As it is, I'm not going to take this lightly. We'll pick this incident to the bone."
Tang and Dosso looked down as further updates scrolled across the table's display surfaces.
"Eng is reporting an object of possible interest," Dosso said.
"Yes,"
Omonier said, speed reading ahead of her peers. "A white structure in the second chamber of the wheel."
"Does it mean anything to you?" Tang asked.
Omonier reflected. It was a reasonable question, and it demanded a considered answer. She studied the single murky image that Eng had sent via her goggles record and transmit facility. The light in the chamber was low, lending the white structure the ghostly aspect of a lightning-struck tree standing alone in moonlight, its angular limbs seeming to reach out as if in embrace, or even the offering of some terrible warning against approaching further.
A parade of shapes and patterns flitted across her mind's eye as her brain searched for a match against the white structure. No human being could know the glitter band in its totality, much less the dazzling range of environments and structures contained within the 10,000 habitats. Even to know it once was to hold only a single futile instant in a waltz of endless change. But Omanie had learned to trust in the correlative accuracy of her memory, and a faint, familiar intuition told her she had not seen this shape before. Perhaps it had meant something to her predecessors, but she had studied the major case files and thought it unlikely. No, she was certain. Whatever this thing was, it had managed not to draw Panoply's interest until now. "I want a name, an owner, and a purpose," she said. "Mildred, feed the image to Vanessa. Tell her to start running it through the search turbines." Dosso nodded. "Eng hasn't given us the slightest explanation as to why the object is of relevance," Tang said. "She hasn't," Omanie said. "But she's also had to deal with the small problem of managing not to die. I imagine she'll enlighten us in her own good time." By the time she met Dreyfus at the vehicle dock, the events in Hospice Idlewild were all over the public networks. He was her friend, and she guessed he had his reasons for what, on the face of it, seemed like a serious professional miscalculation. She still boiled with fury at the thought that Dreyfus had brought this on them all with everything else that was pressing for her attention. It looked bad, Omanie had to admit. There were no surveillance feeds in Hospice Idlewild. The mendicants refused it. But Garland's bodyguards had filmed the whole spectacle anyway, and it hadn't taken them long to distribute the recording across the public networks. Lillian Beaudry, next to her in the pressurized area of the dock, said, "Try to look on the bright side, Supreme Prefect. At least he used minimum necessary force." "Is that an attempt to excuse his actions?" "Hardly, but everyone has their breaking point. That place is sacrosanct to Dreyfus." She ground her teeth. "I know what it means to him. And no matter what Garland might say, it looks like calculated provocation to show up there, just when Dreyfus is paying a visit to Valerie." "He can't have known," Omanie said. "Dreyfus was on Panoply business at the parking swarm. Then you're saying it was just a wild coincidence?" Beyond armored glass, the cutter settled into its docking cradle. Connections closed around the hull. Omanie grimaced, thinking how curious it was that the universe could make any prior situation seem only mildly troublesome, when, at the time, it had seemed to encompass all conceivable woes. She longed to be sitting back in the tactical room, listening to Sparva, thinking only of exploding heads. "I forgot to mention," Beaudry said, pausing as if to judge Omanie's mood, "that woman's been trying to reach you again." "Woman? Hestia Del Mar, the one from Chasm City, Marshal Detective or whatever she calls herself. She called again just now, reminding you about those three fugitives." "I told her we had nothing. We don't retain records of citizen movements."
"She seems persistent."
"She's a fool, and too much like me for my own tastes," Omanie added silently. "She doesn't understand the scope of our operations, or the threats and emergencies we face on a continual basis. I'd kill to have nothing but three fugitives to keep me awake at night."
"I thought you put Germal on to the problem," Beaudry asked.
"I did," Omanie said, curling her lower lip as she tried to push away feelings of guilt and duplicity. "I also told her to use her discretionary powers,
which is a polite way of saying give the impression of taking the queries seriously, but stall for as long as possible."
"No. Germal understood. She definitely understood." She looked at Beaudry, waiting for reassurance.
"I wanted the query looked at, but not at the expense of diverting our time and energy from the real emergency."
She set her jaw determinedly. "I'll make sure Germal understands the delicacy of the situation, but Hestia Del Mar has to understand we're not..." Clearmountain joined them at the lock.
"Dreyfus has really exceeded himself," he said, shaking his head, but very clearly taking a certain morbid delight in this latest turn of events.
"Perhaps in hindsight it was a mistake for him to continue with field duties after the Aurora emergency," Beaudry ventured. "I've always respected him, but..."
"But what, Lillian?" Omanier demanded. She was still thinking of Hestia Delmar, oddly troubled by her own lack of helpfulness towards the woman, and the vague way she had delegated the matter over to Germal. The lock sequenced. Devon Garlin came out first, helped by a gentle shove from Dreyfus. His hands were secured behind his back, but he showed no signs of injury or maltreatment, and if his clothes had been damaged or scuffed in the arrest, they had repaired and self-cleaned on the journey. Garlin looked at Omanier. Doubtless he recognized her. All of the senior prefects involved in the Aurora crisis had become public figures, at least in the immediate aftermath of the emergency.
"I owe you a debt of gratitude," he said,
his face oddly composed.
"You've done more for my cause in the last 2 hours than I've managed in months."
"I wouldn't be so cocky," Omanier said, staring into his ice-blue eyes without blinking. "If you're found to have violated the Articles of Public Order, you won't have a cause to go back to."
"Then there's some doubt about culpability, is there?"
He twisted around to look at the man behind him.
"That's odd, because Dreyfus couldn't have sounded more certain."
"The stability of the Glitter Band depends on social cohesion, Mr. Garlin. We don't have standing armies. We don't have a citizen militia. Even the local constabularies constitute a vanishingly small proportion of our population. But this system only functions in the absence of malicious fear-mongering. I have no time for those who disseminate lies and half-truths for their own ends.
Either there's a crisis or there isn't, Supreme Prefect. Or are you seriously suggesting that you arrested a man because he had the temerity to repeat a rumour? What's next? A moratorium on gossip?"
She nodded at Clear Mountain. "Take him to a debriefing room, please, Gaston. I'll be along shortly."
"I brought him here for interviewing, not debriefing," Dreyfus said.
Omanier fixed him in the eyes.
"I'd like a word, Tom. It won't take long."
Near the middle of Panoply, a modest area had been set aside as a miniature forest, a steamy, rambling maze of dense greenery and dripping, burbling waters. Omanier had designed the space. The hothouse's confusing, beguiling geometries had been laid out in her mind during her long convalescence, those weeks before she regained motor control of her limbs, and had little to do but stare at the ceiling. It was meant for all of the prefects and analysts, irrespective of rank. The winding, branching paths were supposed to encourage non-linear thought processes and counterintuitive jumps of logic. By some silent consensus, though, it seemed to have remained Omanier's personal space. She rarely encountered anyone else during her walks, and after some initial misgivings, she had gradually come around to an acceptance of the arrangement, even quietly welcoming it. Now she walked with Dreyfus, a brook bubbling alongside the path, filling in the silence that had prevailed since they had started their stroll.
"I thought better of you," she said, finally speaking. "I still think better of you."
"It was an act of provocation."
"Of course it was. Do you think I'm a fool? He knew exactly where and when he needed to be to extract that response from you, and you should have had the professional detachment to ignore it completely, to turn the other cheek."
Dreyfus started.
"Speaking? And before you say you don't like demagogues, I don't like political embarrassments that give the moral ground to our enemies. You were right to be angry, Tom. I don't blame you for that. But you should have exercised the discretion and good judgment I normally feel able to count on."
Dreyfus walked on in silence, clearly thinking very carefully about the next thing he was about to say.
"He knows more than he should. You can excuse his knowledge of the wildfire deaths if you wish. Maybe he really is just picking up on rumours and using them to stoke public unrest. But that doesn't account for him showing up in Hospice Idlewild.
He'll say it was chance.
And will you believe him? It's part of a pattern, of a man with knowledge he shouldn't have. We're not just dealing with a well-connected agitator here. It's something more than that."
"All right," she said. "Let's take what you're saying at face value.
Garlin has access to information channels he shouldn't have, at least according to your theory. But he's just a man. From a wealthy background. The Voy fortune was frittered away years ago. After Alia died in her shuttle accident, the shell house fell into a ruin.
Being born into that family may have given Devon Garlin an early advantage, but now his whole operation is self-financing. What we know of it?
Don't make this into more than it is, Tom. He's one man, with a few deep-pocketed sponsors and a little more influence than we'd like. That doesn't mean there's some sinister, shadowy cabal behind him, feeding him secret information.
There are other things we can't sense, Dreyfus said. Distributed intelligences spread across the networks.
We've heard nothing from Aurora or the Clockmaker in 2 years. That's because they're so preoccupied with their slow war against each other that they can't spare even a fraction of their energies to bother with our little affairs. So why would either of them start now?
I don't have the answers. I'm saying it looks as if there's something looming behind Garlin, some agency or power that's providing him with this information.
I can't hold a man on that basis, Tom.
From what I gathered, you're not planning to hold him at all.
I won't delay the inevitable. I have no grounds for detaining Garlin, and the longer he stays in Panoply, the more ammunition we'll give him. So I plan to lance the boil immediately.
She walked on, Dreyfus following.
The immediate damage is containable.
No one was hurt, and Garlin will have his liberty back within a few hours. There'll be a fuss, of course, and it will play against us. But I can make a case that you were entitled to detain him under a very literal reading of the articles.
Zealous, that's the word.
My officer may have been overzealous in his duties, but there was no irregularity in his interpretation of the law, and I stand by his actions. Dreyfus evidently felt it safe to smile. So, no demotion, yet?
No, not just yet. It's your tactical judgment I prize, not your ability to give a few commands to a whip-hound.
Keeping a stony face, she added, how did it feel, though,
to take down the snivelling little shit?
I've had worse moments, Dreyfus said. She patted his back. They walked on in silence. Giselin Bronner looked up as Dreyfus entered the interview room, pushing back her sleeve to rub the skin above the wrist where the pain flower had been attached.
If you've come to apologize for the way my security arrangements were bungled, Prefect, you can—
Dreyfus eased into the seat opposite her, and placed a large black evidence box on the table between them. He left it unopened for the moment. I haven't come to apologize, no. But I thought I'd set your mind at ease in one respect. Grobno, the man who fixed that thing onto you, is no longer a concern. I've delivered him to the Ultras, where he'll face their justice.
Their justice?
She slid her sleeve back down.
Is that your idea of a joke, Dreyfus? They sent him in the first place. He'll be rewarded, not punished.
What I mean to say is that Grobno acted alone. There'll be no further repercussions as far as you're concerned. I've had a personal guarantee from Harbormaster Seraphim to that effect.
That name's supposed to mean something, is it?
He's a man I happen to know and trust.
Trust an Ultra?
She made no effort to hide her sneer.
You really haven't had much experience with them, have you?
Enough. Dreyfus reached over and began to undo the lid on the evidence box. Sufficient to know that if you don't try and get one over on them, they'll leave you well alone. They have their own ideas about honour and loyalty, exactly as we do. Just a pity you and Antal didn't take that lesson to heart, isn't it?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Spare me the routine, Madame Bronner. Grobno told me everything I need to know. You were playing one faction of Ultras against another, faking goods, inflating margins, swindling the last people in the universe you really want to make enemies of. Dreyfus set the lid aside and removed the protective wadding from inside the evidence box. Still, that's water under the bridge now. You'll be audited, every transaction you've ever made looked into anew. But that won't concern me. Fraud's a criminal matter, but not something Panoply needs to waste its valuable time pursuing.
Well then,
she began. Dreyfus pulled the white candelabra from the evidence box. He set it on the table by its base, then pushed the box to one side.
This, on the other hand, this interests me quite a bit.
You're insane.
Do you recognize it?
Of course I recognize it. It was in our home. There were others like it. Why have you brought it here?
My operative thought it might be of interest, so she flagged it for evidence collection. Can you explain the significance of the design?
Yes. It holds candles. Should I tell you what candles are for?
Dreyfus paused and reached for the compad at the far end of the table. He called up an image and tilted the compad so Madame Bronner had a clear view of it. You're looking at a structure, presently being investigated in relation to an ongoing inquiry. Your husband's death also relates to that inquiry. Do you recognize the structure?
No.
Would you like to reflect on that answer a little longer?
I don't recognize it, so why should I? It's just a white building. Where is it?
I'm not at liberty to say.
What do you mean my husband's death was part of an ongoing inquiry? We know why he died, and the people behind it.
She paused, as if she might also have admitted too much. But then some belated acceptance seemed to come over her.
You even had the man who did it. What more is there to say?
Grobnow didn't kill your husband, Dreyfus stated. I doubt he was even aware of your husband until after his death. But that death was part of a larger pattern. The building may relate to that pattern.
If you know where that building is, why don't you just go there and find out?
My operatives are already investigating it. But I think your husband may have known about that building, or had some contact with it.
He'd have mentioned it.
Can you explain the similarity with the candelabra? The narrow stem, the branching structure, those globe-like candle holders?
Ask Antal. You can speak to his beta level, even if you won't let me.
Was he responsible for the candelabra?
I never liked them, all right? He had them made. They were meant to be sold on to the ultras, faked up to look like something more valuable than they were. But Antal decided to keep them. He wanted them in the house.
Something softened in Dreyfus, if only for a moment. Do you know why?
Like I said, ask him.
Perhaps I will. But there's someone else I could speak to as well. Dreyfus tilted the compad again, so that they both had a clear view of it.
Madame Bronner,
he asked, raising his voice.
I'm sitting right here, you idiot.
On the compad, a lone figure turned slowly, eyes searching in various directions, as if hearing a noise in fog, a sound that they could not immediately localize. They continued looking around in confusion, lost in a cloying silvery whiteness.
Who's there?
Madame Bronner, this is Prefect Dreyfus. You've been sequestered by Panoply. I'm with your living instantiation at this very moment. You've both been brought in for interviewing in relation to an ongoing investigation.
You can't sequester her,
the seated widow said.
You have no right. I've done nothing wrong. I'm not even dead. This is an affront, said the simulated widow, stepping nearer to Dreyfus.
When our lawyers hear about this, began the living widow.
He has no right,
the simulation said. Well, I'm glad you can agree on something, Dreyfus said, eyeing both versions of Madame Bronner, because it may make this a little easier. I suspect that the living instantiation of you was engaged in commercial fraud. If it's found to be the case, she'll be prosecuted under the usual civilian laws of the Glitter Band.
What does that have to do with me?
Asked the simulation. Quite a bit, Dreyfus said. Whatever sentence is decided, it would be fully applicable to both the living and beta-level instantiations of you.
That's completely unreasonable,
the beta-level interrupted. I didn't draft the laws, Dreyfus said, managing to sound suitably unmoved. A beta level shadows and mimics its primary instantiation very closely. That's the whole point, after all. Close enough to embody knowledge of criminal activity. To become a tacit or active accomplice? Who can say? But if there are reasonable grounds for suspicion...
I was brought here for protection, not to be treated like a common criminal,
the living widow said. Dreyfus led the candelabra until it was in clear view of both the versions of Madame Bronner. Here's the deal. I can't offer immunity from prosecution,
but I can make a case to the civil authorities that one or both of you were of assistance to Panoply in a wider investigation. But I'd need to be persuaded that you are offering me genuinely useful information, especially where that information relates to your recently departed husband. What are you talking about? Asked the Beta Level. I want to know why Antol had these candelabra commissioned, what they meant to him, and anything you can tell me about a white building that shares a similar form. Dreyfus flashed a smile. I'll give you time to think it over, shall I? Half an hour. He rose from the table and left the living and unliving versions of Giselin Bronner to consider their decision. Omonier stepped through the pass wall and conjured up a chair, sitting down opposite Devon Garlin. He started to speak, but Omonier raised a cautionary finger and said, "Save yourself, Mr. Garlin. This needn't take up much of your precious time. I have a high-speed corvette ready and waiting to take you back to the Glitterband. Name your destination, and we'll have you safe and dry before you can blink."
I was brutalized.
He touched his throat, as if he had been throttled.
Set upon for speaking freely, for exercising my rights as a free citizen of the Glitterband.
Omonier pinched her features in mock contrition.
It's a shame things happened the way they did.
A shame?
He looked at her with startled disbelief.
Is that the extent of your apology?
Oh, it's not an apology. Nothing of the sort. You were detained, as was our right, and now you are being released. This sort of thing happens all the time, Mr. Garlin. So please don't make it all about you.
This won't end here.
I think it will.
Omonier leaned forward. You'll go back to being the low-level irritant you have so far proven to be. I have every confidence that your breakaway movement will burn out of its own accord, like a weak fever. You may continue to spread populist, rabble-rousing nonsense as you see fit. As far as I'm concerned, the local constabularies can deal with you. You're not enough of a problem to keep me awake at night, and believe me, I'm a very light sleeper. But you will never go near Hospice Idlewild again.
You can't forbid.
Did I say I was done?
She elevated her chin, looking down at him along the length of her nose.
Don't talk to me about what is and isn't forbidden. You scuttle into the protection of the laws of the Glitterband when it suits you, but at the same time you hold the entire institution in utter, loathsome contempt. You're dirt, Mr. Garlin, and if I didn't respect those laws and conventions as much as I do, I'd gladly find a way to silence you. But I won't. I will, though, tell you that you'd be very ill-advised to test my patience in the future. And going near Hospice Idlewild without excellent reason would be a very effective way of doing so.
She allowed herself a breath, giving him the full cold stare.
Beyond that, you'll show no more interest in Dreyfus. You've made an enemy of him, and frankly, he has my complete sympathy. Dreyfus doesn't like demagogues.
I'll confess I take a harder line.
I despise you. I'd like to smear you out of existence before you damage something very precious to me.
Garlin leaned as far back as his seat permitted. He swallowed.
This is an outrage!
No. This is off the record. You're still below my threshold of interest, but you should be aware that you're buzzing around dangerously close to it. Consider your moves very wisely, Mr. Garlin. You'd hate to make an enemy of me.
Omonier rose from the chair and dismissed it back into the floor with a flick of her wrist.
That's all I wanted to say. Enjoy your trip back.
Cassandra Leng had her favoured haunts in Necropolis, away from the gathering places of the other wildfire cases. Dreyfus had learned where best to look for her, preferring to seek her out rather than invoke her presence, even if it cost him a few minutes of wandering. He watched her now from a distance, studying her seated form. She was on one of the benches near the lakeside, hands settled in her lap, her posture one of contemplative repose. She wore a dark red outfit today, with a long skirt, full-length sleeves, and a stiffened collar that flared up into a sort of bonnet. What he could see of her face was in profile, like a cameo. She was looking out across the greying waters,
her expression cryptic. He found himself wondering what was going on inside her head in these intervals when she was not required to engage in conversation. Then he chided himself, because even to think of her having selfhood, let alone an interior existence, was a fallacy he had sworn he would never allow himself to fall into again. He had known a beta level once, witness to an appalling crime, and despite the opinions of the theorists, she had come close to convincing him that she had a private consciousness, a true inner life. He had believed it, too, for a time, the force of her personality dismantling his convictions. Later, for the sake of his own professional detachment, he had tried to go back to his old way of thinking, treating the betas as merely elaborate filigreed shadows of a life once lived. It was easier that way, simpler to go about his business. He told himself that he had put the doubts to rest, but as he approached Cassandra Lang, he still felt as if he were intruding on some private reverie, trespassing on the thoughts and feelings of another human being. "Prefect," she said, roused from her stillness, turning to look at him as he neared. "Come to grill me again, is it? Aren't some of the others starting to get a little jealous of the attention?"
"They'll cope."
"Goodness, practically an admission." A teasing half-smile appeared on her face. "You don't deny it, then? You have been singling me out."
"Hard not to, Cassandra. You'll always be the first.
You've also been one of the more cooperative witnesses." She touched her throat and the bonnet collapsed down into the collar, tidying itself away with a snap of air. "It's easy when you've nothing to hide." Dreyfus sat next to her on the bench. He said nothing for a few moments, reflecting on her words and the unarguable proposition that he had been drawn to her beyond the other cases. It was true, and if part of it was indeed for the reasons he had stated, her primacy, her willingness to speak bluntly about her former life, then there was also the part that he was less comfortable with. The similarity to Valerie, he saw in her. That openness, that unflinching lack of sentiment. But more than that, the down curve of her lips, when she was thoughtful. The set of her jaw, the green of her eyes, made more obvious by the dark red fabric of her outfit. He wanted to stop himself, to treat her with the same ruthless indifference he reserved for the others. But whenever he came close to acting on that intention, he would only end up sitting or walking with her again, deepening the groove of their relationship, making things worse. He said, "Did you hear much about Devon Garland before you died?"
"That man? Yes. He was hard to miss."
She looked at him sharply.
"Why?
What has he done now?" Dreyfus sniffed, smiling at his own foolishness.
"It's more about what I've done, Cassandra."
The sharpness turned to a frown, then an amused puzzlement that had some trace of concern in it.
"And you feel that I'm the one to talk to?"
"You're as good an audience as any. You'd be surprised how hard it is to find a neutral pair of ears in panoply. People are either for me or against me, but there's very little middle ground."
"You must have some friends."
"They're busy and much too willing to see my side of things."
"Family, then? I once asked you about that. You said you had a wife, and that was the end of the discussion." "I didn't press."
"I do have a wife,"
Dreyfus said, looking down at his shoes, the gravel of the path, the shape and texture of each piece of stone, the astonishing verisimilitude of it all. "As it happens, I went to visit her recently."
"You're estranged?"
"No, not exactly. But my wife isn't well. Years ago she was involved in something that left her very damaged. There are some people looking after her, seeing if they can help her to become a little better. They're very kind, and I believe them when they say they see signs of progress. But I don't know if I really believe there's any difference."
"I'm sorry, Dreyfus."
"There are worse things, Cassandra. I still love her, and I think she recognizes me enough to have reciprocal feelings. But it's a hard road. One day, they say, she may get back the power of language. Until that happens, though..."
He paused, collecting himself.
"It's not my wife I mean to talk about, but when I was visiting her, I ran into Devon Garland."
"This place? Did he have any business there?"
"None that I can see.
It was an odd coincidence, if that's what it was. I prefer to see it as a goad. Her eyes narrowed with interest.
Did he know about your wife?
I don't see how he could have, but he was there. I either accept that it was an unlikely coincidence, or that the encounter was somehow